Good morning. I'm going to be talking to you about GRIPS today. The ultimate goal of GRIPS is to eliminate or reduce violent re-injury and criminal involvement of firearm assault survivors and their close social contacts. Our methods were developed using guidelines produced by the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs, and we employ three culturally competent outreach workers referred to as interventionists, with extensive experience in violence prevention and case management. And here you can see our logo. It is a bridge. Pittsburgh is known for its bridges, so that's what that's about. I have no relationships to disclose. I will be describing our enrollment process, the case management and social support intervention, demographic and research data, and some preliminary outcomes. We recruit firearm assault survivors from the Level 1 Trauma Centers of Pittsburgh, so that's Presbyterian, Mercy, and Allegheny General Hospitals. We can also recruit from Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, but so far we have not enrolled anyone from this site, in part because only those age 18 and older are eligible. We encourage firearm assault survivor participants to refer close social contacts for inclusion in the intervention, so that can be family members, friends, significant others. To date, we have enrolled 59 firearm assault survivors and 35 social contacts. In this presentation, I will primarily describe data from our first 50 firearm assault survivor participants, unless otherwise noted. GRIPS personnel work with staff at each of our hospital sites, so that can be nurses, care managers, social workers, physicians, and others, to explain the importance of our program and to encourage them to make referrals. We have forged a strong working relationship with our hospital partners, but there are certainly some ongoing challenges to being outsiders working in the hospital environment. We found that maintaining a high level of communication with our hospital sites is key. GRIPS personnel are available for meetings with hospital staff and presentations of our findings. The photo on the left is an email informing staff that one of our interventionists will be presenting at their trauma conference meeting. And our brochures and other materials are distributed to hospital sites, both for recruitment of participants and for keeping staff informed. The photo on the right is some of our brochures at Mercy Hospital. Here's a graph of our participant enrollment from May of 2014 through September of 2015. As I said earlier, we've enrolled 59 firearm assault survivors and 35 social contacts. Although we actually initially hoped to enroll two social contacts for every firearm assault survivor, this proved to be an unrealistic goal. It has been more difficult to enroll social contacts than survivors, in part because unlike the firearm assault survivor participants who are referred to our staff by hospital staff members, the firearm assault survivors are the ones who are actually referring their social contacts to us. So we don't really have the same level of access to them that we actually have to the survivors. That was a bit unexpected. Source population data was provided by our hospital partner sites for May of 2014 through May of 2015, or year one of our study. Getting the source population data from each site was a bit of a challenge, but we're really working to streamline our data collection process for the future, kind of part of that ongoing effort to improve our communication with each of our sites. A patient is considered to be in the eligible population if the patient was discharged alive, had a length of stay of more than one day in the hospital, and was at least age 18. On average, around a quarter of the eligible population from each hospital site was recruited and enrolled. The GRIPS participant population is similar to the source population, but at all three sites is a bit older on average and more likely to be Black. In two of the hospital sites, the GRIPS participant population was 100% male, demonstrating an underrepresentation of female participants from these sites. And the third site actually had a higher percentage of female recruitment than the source population for this hospital site. So despite these differences, the sample is fairly representative overall by age, race, and gender. Next, I will describe the case management and social support process. Our interventionists work with participants to create an individual plan at baseline with the seven goal areas listed here. Some of our most frequently requested services are employment assistance, safety-based relocation, mental health counseling, and assistance with obtaining a driver's license or ID. And here is a photo of our three program interventionists discussing case management. Interventionists attempt at least monthly contact over the course of the six-month study period, but contact is usually more frequent during the first month or two of the intervention. At that point, contact may be weekly or in some cases even daily, depending on the needs of the participant. Contact may be in person or over the phone, and includes mentoring, social support, and case management. Interventionists complete monthly case status forms to track participant progress toward the goal areas that I listed on that previous slide. Maintaining contact over the course of the six-month study period is a challenge. The participant population is often unstable and transient, which can really hinder communication. Inconsistent addresses and frequently disconnected telephone numbers are just two of the challenges. Additionally, speaking with interventionists may not be a priority of some of our participants once their health improves and they return to the challenges of their daily lives. And we lost around a third of participants within their first 2 months. I will briefly describe some demographic and research data from the baseline questionnaire responses of the first 50 firearm assault survivor participants. The majority are Black or African American males. Around two-thirds have children. And despite 69% having completed at least a high school level of education, 69% are unemployed. And the median age of this population was 24. In our questionnaire, we ask about violent and illegal behaviors. Here we examine reported behavior in the past 30 days, and you'll see that physical fights are not uncommon, reported by around a quarter of participants. 12% report involvement in a gang fight in the past 30 days, which is actually the same percentage that report gang membership, which I will mention later. Selling drugs is also common among our participant population at nearly 40%. And around a quarter of the population carried an unlicensed gun in the past 30 days. None of the participants said that it was likely that they would join a gang, but that may be because 12% are already members of gangs or gang sects. And although a relatively small percentage of participants reported gang membership, more than half had family members and friends who belonged to gangs or used to belong. The majority of participants expressed fairly negative attitudes toward gangs, including the belief that gang membership is dangerous and does not make members safer or offer protection. Given that many respondents have friends and family members who affiliate with gangs, as shown in that previous table, it's unsurprising that 58% of respondents reported that their friends would not think less of them if they joined a gang. Participants were asked to report on drug and alcohol use over the course of the past 30 days. Participants reported high levels of marijuana use, with 70% using marijuana at least once and 40% reporting daily use. Binge drinking is not uncommon among participants, with 45% reporting at least one incidence of binge drinking, which is 5 drinks for men and 4 drinks for women on an occasion. But that's somewhat similar to the national average for this age group. Ecstasy use was reported by 18% of participants, and 16% reported illegal prescription drug use. We found substantial mental health needs in our population. Using the PHQ-9 depression screening tool, 20% of participants screened positive for at least moderate depression. Using the GAD-7 generalized anxiety disorder screening tool, 34% of participants screened positive for at least moderate generalized anxiety disorder. And using the abbreviated civilian PTSD checklist, 45% of participants screened positive for PTSD. And as we expected to, and you might expect, we found a strong positive correlation between PTSD and anxiety, as well as a moderate positive correlation between anxiety and depression, and between PTSD and depression. So these are clearly very interrelated issues. We also found a moderate correlation between depression and gang membership, and some positive correlation between selling drugs and carrying an unlicensed gun, as well as between selling drugs and getting into a physical fight. I'll now briefly describe our retention and preliminary outcomes. Here we have a diagram representing the level of intervention received by participants. Around a third of participants, as I mentioned earlier, failed to maintain at least 2 months of contact with program interventionists. Of the remaining two-thirds, 61% obtained at least one referral to a service provider. And of those participants who received a referral to a service provider, half have a documented successful link with the service provider and the other half do not. So there was a high rate of loss to follow-up among program participants. In fact, only 7, which is 14% of the firearm assault survivor participants, actually completed that 6-month follow-up questionnaire. So it's really unlikely that enough of the follow-up questionnaires will be collected to allow for a comparison from baseline to follow-up, which is unfortunate, but it may be the reality of working with this participant population. As mentioned earlier, our outcomes of interest are criminal involvement and violent reentry. Criminal arrest data are from publicly available online criminal dockets from the Court of Common Pleas of Allegheny County. 3 participants were arrested on drug charges during the study period, and 2 additional participants were arrested on other charges after their study period had ended. And I want to mention that at baseline, 16% of participants reported having been arrested in the course of the past 30 days. That's not a direct comparison to these numbers, since the self-reported data likely includes arrests that would not be included in these criminal docket arrest records, but I still wanted you to have that number in mind. Our violent reinjury data are preliminary, but so far we have 1 violent reinjury during the study period and 1 after, and we'll be working with our hospital partners to try to get some more complete reinjury data to make sure we're capturing all of them. In conclusion, I offer a few takeaway points. Firearm assault survivors are receptive to recruitment from hospital sites, but retaining participants for 6 months is a challenge. We have identified some key service needs of this population, including mental health and substance use counseling, safety-based relocation, and employment assistance. And we look forward to continued measurement of our outcomes and evaluation of our process as the study progresses toward its enrollment goal of 100 firearm assault survivor participants. Here is a list of my fellow authors and my colleague and GRIPS principal investigator, Stephen Albert. Steve, hi, is presenting a poster this afternoon about the homicide review that's part of our larger violence prevention initiative. So I wanted to give him a shout out as well. Thank you so much.